Do juries place too much value on expert testimony? How often is someone pressured into confessing to a crime they didn't commit? We are going to talk about what our guest calls the unfairness of our criminal injustice system this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. According to our guest legal scholar, the biggest problem with the criminal justice system is us, our psychology, and the prejudices that shape every step of the process. He'll describe how our internal prejudices work against finding the truth and what can be done to fix all aspects of the process. And we will welcome your questions and views, too. We'll wonder if you think our criminal justice system is systematically unfair. Do you think the biggest problem is with the police or juries or witnesses? Have you observed any of these prejudices firsthand? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Adam Benferrato, an associate professor of law at Drexel University. His writing has appeared in publications that include the Washington Post, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Legal Times. He is author of Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
So why do you say we have a criminal injustice system?
Well, I think over the last several months, problems in the criminal justice system have certainly come into the public's attention in a way that hasn't been true, I think, really. And I think that what I was interested in, you know, in becoming a law professor and doing research over a number of years was trying to find about why we have so many problems. And what I have discovered in my research and my teaching and speaking with other scholars is that there are hidden forces that are shaping the behavior of police officers, detectives, jurors, witnesses, and really determining outcomes in a way that a lot of us are completely unaware.
Yeah. Well, like what?
So I think a great example, one of my favorite studies in the book looked at the decision whether to grant someone parole. And so these researchers looked at actual parole boards in Israel. And I teach criminal law. I would have told you that things that determined that outcome before reading this study were how severe a crime the person committed and whether they reformed themselves in prison. But when these researchers tracked actually the factors that were determining whether someone was granted parole or not, what they found, the single most important factor, was simply the time of day when the person happened to appear before the parole board. Coming before the parole board first thing in the morning was a really, really good time to come. You had a much greater chance of being granted parole. Right before the first break in the day, that was a terrible time to come before the board. And although we're still trying to figure out what the mechanism here is, the best theory at this point is that we become cognitively depleted as the day goes on. So first thing in the morning, we have a lot of cognitive energy, and that allows us easily to deviate from the status quo. As the day goes on, we tend to stick with the status quo, and in this case, that's leaving someone in prison to serve the rest of their sentence.
Oh, I get it. And just before break, we're crabby and we want to have a break.
Exactly. I think all of us have experienced these things. Yet when we talk about the criminal justice system, what's moving the criminal justice system, when law professors like myself go and teach students, we don't focus on these factors. And yet these are the things that are really shaping how outcomes happen.
You know, Adam, though, some will say, all right, one study is not a new science, it's a junk science.
Yeah, so I think that that's often the argument, and that's why I look at really literally hundreds of studies, and there are thousands and thousands of studies out there that have developed over the last couple of decades, looking at everything from eyewitness identifications to false confessions to police brutality. And I think that at this point, it's really hard to say that this is junk science. And I think the thing that I would especially push back on is a lot of the people who come up with this criticism are defending principles and practices in our criminal justice system that are based on no science at all. So for hundreds, if not thousands of years, we've developed different ideas, notions about human memory, about why people commit crimes, which are really based on nothing but myth, baseless assumptions. And so what's great about, I think, the time we live in today is that we have these amazing tools from science to begin to actually come up with correct models about how our memories work and how people behave in pressured situations when, say, they are encountering a suspect.
So who's affected by the unfairness in the system? We talk a lot about race. Is that the only consequence?
No. So in this book, I really try to show the whole picture. So I take all of the characters in our criminal justice system, and I start with victims. I then talk about police officers. I talk about judges. I talk about jurors. And then I move really from the adjudication phase to punishment. And I look at how people are treated in our prisons, whether our prisons do what we think they do. And I think one of the really good things come out of the protests that have occurred over the last several months is a real focus on police brutality and issues of race. But that's really only, I think, a small part of the overall picture of injustice in this country.
Well, let's walk through some of the different areas where you say there are issues with unfairness. Where's that issue when it comes to the victims?
So with respect to victims, one of the things that I got very interested in early on in being a law professor was reading cases and seeing how we sum people up often very, very quickly based on things that are actually not good diagnostic cues. So it might be the color of someone's skin. It might be whether they look rich or poor. It might be the smell on their breath. And so one of the stories that I tell in the book is about this man who's found in a wealthy suburb of Washington, D.C. He's lying on the ground. A man walks out of his house, comes up to the man, and as soon as the police pull up and the first fire engine pulls up, the man begins to vomit. One of the firefighters says, I smell alcohol on this guy's breath. He's a homeless drunk. And so when the police arrive, they're told, you know, keep to the periphery, nothing to see here, it's just a drunk. When the ambulance drivers arrive, they just kind of throw him in the back. They don't take him to the closest hospital, as is required by protocol. They take him to one that's a little bit closer for them to do some errands. He's left in the hallway to just sleep it off. After all, he's just a drunk. And then all of a sudden, you know, hours later, a nurse notices this man doing sort of this strange behavior, which is associated not with alcohol abuse, but rather with a head injury. He's rushed into surgery. It turns out that he dies. And this was no homeless drunk. This was a New York Times award-winning reporter who'd sat down for dinner with his wife around the corner, gotten the hiccups, gone out for a walk, and been hit over the head with a bar by two assailants who robbed him. And in this case, I could just see, and I track in the book, how this simple label that this is a drunk gets transferred between all of these actors in our emergency response teams and in our criminal justice system. And once that label is attached, it's extremely, extremely hard to take off. And this is a problem. I mean, this definitely is a problem when it comes to racial labels, but this is also a problem when it comes to a whole range of other issues. And the really frightening thing is that when we have these labels, we just tend to interpret all of the evidence that we come across subsequently in a case in line with what we already believe to be true. And so even seemingly objective types of analysis, DNA analysis, fingerprint analysis can be affected by these labels, by these initial assumptions. So with research, a really interesting initial study was done with respect to DNA evidence. You think, well, that's just cut and dry, but it's not. Knowing that someone, right, if you're a DNA technician, knowing that someone has confessed to a crime already, or knowing that there's an eyewitness that has ID'd this person, can affect how you interpret the sample.
So the DNA technician might mistakenly interpret a sample one way because they think this person confessed already anyway.
Exactly, and this is commonly called confirmation bias, and it happens, unfortunately, in a whole range of issues. It happens with judges. It happens with jurors. We tend to confirm what we already believe to be true, and so things that, when we come across evidence or information that doesn't align, we tend to downplay that evidence. When we find evidence that actually is pretty weak, we actually say, oh, this is great evidence of guilt, because that aligns with what we are, our theory that we're already operating with.
Yeah, and if there was an eyewitness, that's a double whammy, because doesn't the science show that eyewitnesses are often wrong?
It does, and it's really scary. I mean, one of there were many stories that I came across in writing this book that I just was stopped in my tracks. But I think the one that really was hit me hardest was a photograph I found from 1979 of a lineup, and this was a brutal rape. The victim was brought in a couple weeks later. She looked at these five men down at the local jail, and she said, yep, it's number three. Now, it turned out it was not this man, John Jerome White. He spent something like 2 decades in prison for a crime he did not commit. That was not what surprised me about this photograph. What was surprising was two men over from John Jerome White was the actual perpetrator. He just happened to be locked up in the jail for an unrelated offense. He was pulled in as a filler. And what that means is this woman, who'd been face-to-face with her attacker, looked at him again, eye-to-eye, and picked out the man standing two people over. And what this shows, I think, is that having good intentions, having every incentive to get it right, isn't enough, and that our memories don't work the way that we believe they work. They're not the cameras. They're easily manipulated. They're easily changeable. And what we know is, although tens of thousands of people end up being charged with crimes based on eyewitness identifications, like in this case, we know that a third of the time, when someone picks someone out of a lineup, a real lineup, they pick out an innocent filler. And so we're incredibly reliant on eyewitnesses, and yet the data suggests that they're really unreliable. And that's one of the reasons in the book that I suggest that we really need to focus more on treating eyewitness memory more like we treat other types of evidence. We're so careful with blood evidence, for instance. We're very careful how we collect it. We're very careful how we preserve it. We need the same type of approach when it comes to eyewitnesses, because eyewitness memory is just as easily corrupted, just as easily changed, and can just as easily result in a wrongful conviction.
Yeah. And as for that suspect who confessed, we're finding out more and more that that confession isn't always truthful, that it may have been forced.
This is one of the things that I think, you know, my students and certainly people as I go around the country talking to different groups find hardest to believe, is that false confessions are real. I think people can entertain the idea that someone might falsely confess to some really low-level crime, but not to a murder or a rape, something with serious consequences where you might be facing life in prison or the death penalty. And what we know now, as a result of DNA exonerations since the 1980s, is that false confessions are quite common, actually. You know, out of the first sample, I think it's something like, out of the first 250 DNA exoneration cases, it was something like a quarter of them had false confessions or false incriminating statements collected. why does this happen? Well, I think it really has to do with the most commonly used interrogation technique in the United States, which is known as the Reed technique. And how this technique works is the suspect is brought into usually a windowless room, and the detective's first goal and the first part of the technique is simply to sort of assess whether the person's lying or not. And the problem with this is the cues that detectives are told to focus on are not good ways to tell whether someone is lying. So the things that they are told and the things that people commonly think are really good cues for deceit are things like jittery limbs or not looking the detective in right square in the eyes. Those are actually very, very bad predictors of deceit. Now, once the detective decides that someone's lying, under the Reed technique, they're informed that they should switch to basically something akin to the good cop, bad cop routine that we've all seen on television, what's referred to as maximization and minimization. The focus here is just extract a confession. Don't revisit whether this person might be lying, might be guilty. Your goal is to get to a confession, and you should do anything you can within some bounds to get there. That is, you should play up what's going to happen to this person, how horrible it is, and you should buddy-buddy up to the person and say, well, you know, we've all been there. I've fought with my wife before, and, you know, I can totally understand, you know, why you might lose your cool. All of that is focused on getting a confession. It's highly coercive. And the real danger here is that the person who is on the receiving end of this routine often thinks, oh, I'm experiencing acute distress, and I just need to relieve this extreme discomfort that I'm feeling. These hours and hours I've been locked in this room, I'm just going to say that I did it. They're going to stop yelling at me, stop pressing me, and then as soon as I say that they do it, I did it, I can go back, relax, and they can go to work and collect other evidence, and they'll very quickly figure out that I didn't do it. My alibis will check out. Other witnesses will come forward. And the real danger here is that once you have confessed, the police stop looking for anyone else. The game is over. They're not following up on any other leads, on any other suspects. They have a confession, and they know they can get a conviction as soon as they have a confession.
We are talking with Adam Benferrato. He is an associate professor of law at Drexel University. He is the author of Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. We are talking about the various psychological forces that undermine our criminal justice system. And we're welcoming your questions, maybe even your own experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking with the author of Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. Adam Benferrato is an associate professor of law at Drexel University. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you would like to talk about how various psychological forces affect our criminal justice system, from interrogations to the courtroom and beyond. Craig in De Pere is with us first. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Cardine. Thank you for having me on your show. My comment is, 15 years ago, I was a victim of a false allegation of sexual misconduct, and I was appalled, absolutely appalled at how the police handled this. The lead investigator actually was a night watchman sidelined in my building. And just reading over the transcripts of what was said could have told right then and there that there was absolutely no truth to what was said. The woman I had started to date actually ended up being married. And when she got caught by her husband, then started claiming that I had forced her to be with me and drug her across the parking lot by her hair in a heavily populated area. None of it made sense. Complete lies. then the officer goes to my place of work and starts telling people, well, this is a bad guy. Surely he looked at you wrong. He must have said something that made you extremely uncomfortable. And the stuff that was spun out of that was unbelievable. Needless to say, this has completely destroyed my life.
And you were yeah. never charged?
Felony charged, and it haunts me to this day. I'm in the medical community, and for me to get credentialed at a hospital is almost impossible.
This is one of the things that I think is really an unappreciated injustice in our system is the people who are falsely charged with crimes, where allegations are made against them. The harm often continues even after people are not convicted or the charges are never actually formally brought. And I think that, the cause here is that as soon as it goes back to what I was talking about with labels, as soon as the label is attached, this guy committed this sex offense or this guy committed this assault, we go about looking for evidence that confirms that that is the case. I actually recently received an email from a woman whose husband, he was a football coach. He was having problems with his cell phone. And so he went to the university where he worked. He handed over the cell phone and he said, oh, can you take off the videos and pictures of my kids on the phone? The technician who took the video and photographs noticed that there was one with a picture of his kids, a video with his kids dancing around after they got out of the bath, and they were naked. And by university protocol, the person who was removing the videos called the police to just check whether this was child pornography. The police officer who came down took a look at it and said, yes, I think this is child pornography. And it turns out, luckily in this case, there was a judge who finally looked at this and said, this isn't child pornography. This is a 5-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 9-year-old goofing around with their dad after a bath, and they're singing songs and doing funny stuff. And yet this man's life was really ruined because once members of the community had heard that this guy was a pedophile, suddenly they looked for other reasons. Well, I remember this one time that he looked at my daughter funny. I remember this time that he, seemed to have more interest in sexual things or something like this. Suddenly we look for all this evidence which confirms what we already knew to be true. And, in corresponding to this with this woman, she was saying how their lives, their family's lives, have really been destroyed based on such little evidence. No criminal charges were brought, ever substantiated in that case, and yet the trajectory of their lives have forever been changed. And I think that's something that we really need to address as a society: is how do we make things more certain and prevent jumping to conclusions?
Evan in Brookfield is with us now. Hi, Evan.
Oh, hey, how's it going?
It's fine. Go ahead with your story, Evan.
Oh, okay, yeah. So I have a friend that was about, 2-3 years ago, and he got wrongly accused, and he was going out on a walk one night, and these two young ladies that were about 18, 19, and at the time they were, they were about 20, and
Evan, I don't think we have to go into every last detail, but the point is he was wrongly accused of some sort of sexual misconduct or sexual assault.
Yes, he was wrongly accused for rape. And what was funny is that I find is when, because they did have, their time. What I don't get is how come they didn't go into their, room when they talk to you and try to get it out of you to see what happened. How come they didn't sit down with the girls that they were with and actually
I'm not sure I follow Evan, but maybe Evan's saying is that the alleged victims were not interrogated to perhaps get them to fess up that this was a false allegation. What about that, Adam?
Yeah. So one of the hard things when it comes to sex offenses is we really need to balance protecting victims and encouraging victims to come forward with protecting the people who are accused of sex offenses because they are treated so seriously and rightfully treated seriously in our society. And we don't balance that always so well. Sometimes we bring charges based on really, really scant evidence that anything has occurred or very weak memories. As you know, the case that I mentioned earlier that happened down in Meriwether County, Georgia, there was really the weakness of that initial identification was never really developed or brought out. And so there's always this tension, I think, between making sure that we protect victims and we don't turn this into really about putting the victim on trial. That has historically been a real problem with rape prosecutions is we would bring often young women onto the stand. They would be their entire sexual histories would be trotted out. And what that resulted in was people who suffered very, very significant crimes not being willing to go into court. And so I think it's something that we need to continue to figure out because we still have instances where we don't have enough evidence and people are wrongfully convicted of rape, but we also still have examples where young women particularly who have suffered rape do not come forward, do not report it to the police, and that's really a problem too.
Yeah, and for that matter, there are cases that might even go to court, and the juries might be thinking, you know what, why was that woman walking alone? Why was that woman dressed that way? Why did that woman allow that man into her apartment? She was asking for it. And that's an unfairness in our criminal justice system, too.
It is, and one of the things that's really interesting about rape, there's a really fascinating study that was done on what determined outcomes in acquaintance rape cases. So not your typical stereotype of, someone hiding in the bushes and jumping out, but rather, someone that maybe it's a college friend or something like that. And what these researchers found was the particular law that was on the books related to rape, whether it required a force requirement or whether it had a defense for reasonably mistaken belief and consent, that didn't matter at all to whether the particular individual was convicted of rape. What mattered was simply the backgrounds and experiences of the particular jurors. So it turned out that the most interesting division was actually between older, more conservative women with more traditional gender norms who tended to see the alleged rapist in these date rape cases as being innocent versus younger, more liberal women with more progressive gender norms who saw often the perpetrator as being guilty.
Let's go next to Ray in Rhinelander. Hi, Ray.
Hi. This is really good because in one of my earlier careers, and I stopped it in the 90s, I was a criminal psychologist. I did psychological profiling. And he's right. Your guest is right. Everything is about the science in the end. When any doubt there is, do further research. Check with the science, check with all the different people, the application, what happened, what didn't happen. Because when you're looking at people in the instance of what did or did not with all these things, there's so many variable and changes. And I've worked with it all and seen it all. But the point I'm getting at is the reason I went into psychological profiling after a while was to go with the evidence, see exactly what happened, didn't happen, and get back to the science. I told my colleagues, when in doubt, go with the science. And that's my opinion, and I would like your guests to comment on that. Thank you very much for presenting all these variables that happened, could happen, and may not have happened.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I mean, I think that that's fantastic, and that's one of the real takeaways of my book. I actually wrote an op-ed in the New York Times a couple weeks ago in which I argue for evidence-based justice. We have evidence-based medicine. For many decades in medicine, determinations were made based on the doctor's gut anecdote. There was a decision that, you know, what we need to do is focus on empirical studies, robust, scientific-based fact in deciding whether treatments work, medications are effective. We need that same commitment, I think, for our police departments, for our prosecutors' offices, and for our prison system. Let's actually look at what the science is telling us about how to conduct eyewitness identifications, how to conduct interrogations, how to treat people in prison so that they don't commit crimes again. We're not doing that enough, but I'm hopeful that moving forward, there's a move in the United States to embrace that approach.
John in River Falls is with us now. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi, Joy. My comment is that I'm a teacher, and in one of our classes, we show a video about a famous murder trial in Great Britain. And the guy that developed DNA profiling, his name is Alec Jeffries. He says in the video at one point that part of the problem is that trials are theater. You know, lawyers are really not. It's not about the truth so much as the theater. So that's all I wanted to say.
So is that a part of the problem, Adam?
I do think that that's a big part of the problem. I think oftentimes things that make for good television, I mean, there's so many shows out there, right, about the trial process, about police officer interactions. What makes for good television makes for really bad justice. And part of that has to do with how we set up our system based on these strong conflicts, these divides. We have the defense and the prosecution locked in this eternal battle, fighting against each other. And we assume that that's the way to best get to the truth. After doing all of this research, writing this book, I don't think it is. I think a lot of times we actually need to diffuse the antagonism, which is a characteristic of our criminal justice system, and focus more on achieving justice, on working together. Just one example of, I think, how that could play out in the real world. Right now, we have the two sides pick their own experts and come in. So if it's a case where someone is pleading insanity defense, we have experts for the defense, we have experts for the prosecution. They're partisan experts. They tend to say exactly what the two sides want to do. And then we leave it to the jury just to decide, well, which side is more convincing. Again, it makes for good, dramatic trials. But why not have experts who are hired by the court? Why not have a panel of psychologists to actually come in and say objectively, not paid for by either side, say objectively what their interpretation is? I think that's the kind of small step we can make that could really, really have an effect in the long run.
Yeah, and why would experts, though, hired by either side have different things to say about the science?
Well, that's because I think in many cases, things that look totally objective are not. I think there's always room for interpretation. And one of the things that worries me about experts is that these people don't even know it's happening. And there's not been quite enough research yet. We need more research on specifically on experts in legal cases. But at least the initial evidence appears to suggest that a lot of times these experts don't even know that they're being biased. It's a very subtle thing. So when the one side hires the expert, they know what outcome is desired by the defense. The defense team may ask questions initially to assess how a particular expert will view things and then, you know, find experts who are more in line. And that's not what our system is meant. That's not how it's meant to work. We actually want to know whether someone qualifies for the insanity defense. We want actually, you know, objective psychological testimony, and we rarely, rarely get that.
We are talking with the author of Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. Adam Benfornato is an associate professor of law at Drexel University. We are talking about the different psychological factors that come into play and undermine our criminal justice system. And we're welcoming your thoughts, your questions. When we come back, we're going to talk about the death penalty. And we'll talk about this case in Oklahoma specifically. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are wondering if you agree with our guest that our criminal justice system is systematically unfair for a number of psychological reasons. And we will talk about how we might change it as well. And we'll welcome your questions and views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Adam Benfornato is the author of Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. I wanted to ask you your reaction, Adam, to this case in Oklahoma. Oklahoma's governor stayed the execution of Richard Glossop yesterday, just minutes before he was scheduled to be executed, because of some procedural questions related to the drugs. Prison officials say that one of the drugs they received was not the right drug. Activists are saying that Glossop was falsely accused of his role in a 1977 murder, and his lawyers have been trying to convince courts to consider new evidence that they say exonerates him. How does the unfairness that you've researched entered into stories like that of Richard Glossop?
So one of the things that we assume is that we've put in so many protections in our system, the ability to appeal, the use of, you know, 12 jurors rather than just one decision maker. We think that really wrongful convictions when it comes to a death penalty case are really impossible. But unfortunately, as I mentioned, with respect to DNA exoneration evidence, we know that people who end up on death row can be innocent. And the research suggests that it's not, you know, one out of a million. It may be, you know, as many as one out of 25 or something like that based on the most recent research. Now, when I see a case like this, I'm happy to see the governor stepping in. I think it gets attention on the deep problems with death penalty. But I also tend to worry that it distracts us from the huge injustice that happens in our prisons, right? So, you know, the death penalty, it really only affects a very, very small number of people in the United States, whereas really thousands and thousands of people suffer as a result of solitary confinement, as a result of really deplorable conditions across our jails and prisons in the United States. So I think, you know, I think this is a good step. I would predict, certainly within our lifetimes, the death penalty is going to be abolished in the United States. I feel confident of that. What I fear is when that moment comes, we are going to pat ourselves on the back and say, oh, look at us. We have gotten rid of injustice in our correction system. And that's not going to be true if we still are placing people in solitary confinement, if we are still locking people in supermax prisons for 23 hours a day and letting them walk around a cage for an hour a day. We need to think more broadly about reforms. And I'm hoping, you know, this just today, there's stories coming out about members of the Senate coming together to unveil this bipartisan approach to getting rid of certain mandatory prison sentences, getting rid of solitary confinement, at least for juveniles. I'm hoping that we can ride that momentum into the next few months.
Yeah. Lots of callers, but I do want to talk a little bit about the there is that movement to end solitary confinement, saying, I mean, what's wrong with putting a prisoner deemed to be dangerous into a solitary confinement?
I think because of the psychological evidence of what solitary confinement does. Kane came back to the United States and talked about his experiences as a prisoner of war. He said that the physical abuse that he suffered was not the worst part. He, you know, this suffered broken bones, been treated, abused horribly, and yet he said the worst part was the solitary confinement. And that really aligns with the broader data that we have on what solitary confinement does to people, ruins their minds, causes them to act out in ways that actually result in them spending longer in prison, and just the fact that oftentimes people are put in solitary confinement for really seemingly benign things. It's little things like having a tattoo or failing to follow some particular prison rules. It can be very, very minor violations with really little oversight on that internal decision by the prison warden. And so I think this is something that we really can't stand for as Americans. I don't think we need it. It does not make us safer. One of the things that we know is people with broken minds who come out of solitary confinement, the vast majority end up back on our streets. So it's not something that's protecting the public. I think it's something that needs to end.
We are talking with Adam Benfornato. He is author of Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. And we're talking about the psychology involved in our criminal justice system and how it is involved with wrongfully convicting people or making us not safe. And we're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Jeff in Wisconsin Dells is with us. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. What is your point?
My point is many years ago when I was much younger in the mid-80s and more impressionable, I attended training, police training, at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glencoe, Georgia, known as FLEETSEA. And we who were there during that training were taught that we were to put everybody in prison that we could, whether they were guilty or not. It's okay because we're all Judeo-Christian who are guilty of something anyway. We just have to find out what it is. And I bit on that. But we were also taught that basically federal prosecutors are not allowed to lose a case, and there are many techniques that are used to make a person look guilty or to frame a person. We were taught how to do that, and at this point in my life, I don't agree with it. At one point in my life, I refused to help, let me say, persecute a politician in another state. I'm in Wisconsin now, but I refused to do that. And I personally spent a couple of years in a federal penitentiary as my punishment. So I've got it from both ends. And so that's my comment, and that's all I wanted to say. I would like people to know that no matter who you are, if you make somebody angry, you can become a target, and you will be convicted. Mm-hmm. And that's the bottom line. So thank
you. Well, that's a cautionary tale. Law enforcement is taught to put innocent people in prison, Adam?
So I think in most jurisdictions today, they are not taught that, but they are taught and emphasized that your job, right, when you go to the academy as a police officer, young police officer, you are told your job is to lock people up. And so these, you know, young guys come out, young guys and women come out, and they hit the streets with an idea of, I'm looking around for violations. And, you know, in writing this book, I went on ride-alongs in Philadelphia and New York. And in the Philadelphia ride-along, I was with a man named Sergeant Patino, and he was telling me that one of his hardest jobs is getting it through these people's head that the job of a successful police officer is being a member of the community, being someone that they turn to. And if you go around, right, writing everyone up for any violation, the community loses its trust. And so if you're writing up people for liquor violations, when there's a murder, those same people are not going to come forward and act as eyewitnesses. And I think that's one of the things, you know, in terms of training, that we need to change the emphasis on community policing, this idea that you're here to help the community, to interact with them, to be good role models, and that actually ends up helping close the most serious cases.
Next we go to John in Cedarburg. Hello, John. What's your question?
Yes, hi. This doesn't relate so much to a wrongful conviction, but relates to what happens to people after they're convicted. In Wisconsin, the Department of Corrections uses lie detector tests with people who are on parole, or I should say probation, especially with sex offenders, to ascertain whether they have reoffended. And on that basis, the probation officer has the power to put the individual automatically in jail, sometimes for up to 6 months, based on lie detector tests. So my understanding is that these tests are not admissible as part of conviction, but they are still using them for probation and using them somewhat capriciously.
Yeah, is that fair, Adam?
Yeah, so this is common not just in Wisconsin, but in a number of states, using lie detectors in order to tell whether someone has spent time, you know, for particularly sex offenders, spent time with, if it was a pedophile charge, spent time with children recently, and the results of these tests are used to with, you know, serious consequences for people. I think that that's terrible. You're exactly right. I think that lie detectors are a very bad way to tell whether someone is telling the truth or not. And so I feel very strongly that determination should not be based on lie detectors, whether we're talking about bringing this into court, usually it is banned, or whether it's being used post-conviction to determine whether someone should be granted parole or has engaged in a parole violation.
Ikes, we only have a couple minutes to go. What do we do to remove this? What's the first step in removing this unfair psychology from our criminal justice system?
Well, I think the first step is to embrace evidence-based justice. I think we need to do that at the police officer level. One of the great things in writing this book is I have heard from police officers who are starting groups advocating for figuring out best practices based on scientific evidence. I think that to a group of prosecutors at the end of this month. I'm meeting with judges. I think at all of these institutions, we can make changes to embrace what the science is telling us about how to make our system better. I think the second part of that process is just collecting data so that we really know what's happening. I was very happy to see that the state of New York is going to start collecting data on police incidents in which force was used. They were collecting the data with respect to shooting, but they weren't collecting the data with respect to use of batons, uses of fists, all that kind of stuff. We can't tell whether there's a problem unless we have the data to show us. And that can happen both for police officers, for judges, for prosecutors. When we have that data, we can start to fashion solutions.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Adam Benferrato is an associate professor of law at Drexel University and author of Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Elizabeth Deliquest for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. And I hope you join us tomorrow at this time. We'll welcome in two guests from opposing political viewpoints to discuss and debate the top stories of the week. It's our Week in Review tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.